to accommodate dead babies, boyfriends, and even favourite sisters. Hadrian was no better on this score than Nero or Gaius in having his young male companion, Antonius, made a god after his mysterious death by drowning in the Nile in 130 CE. The theology of the emperor and the imperial family was far more subtle than this, and has to be seen in two parts. First, the divine status of the living emperor. Second, that of the dead. Throughout the Roman world, the living emperor was treated very like a god. He was incorporated into rituals celebrated in honour of the gods, he was addressed in language that overlapped with divine language, and he was assumed to have some similar powers. Augustus's name, for example, was included in the wording of some religious litanies. Runaway slaves could claim asylum by clinging to a statue of the emperor, just as to a statue of a god. At the town of Gythium, near Sparta in the Peloponnese, a surviving inscription lays out in great detail the procedures for a regular festival to be held over several days, with processions around the town, musical contests, and sacrifices honouring a pair of local benefactors, the ruling emperor Tiberius, and various members of his family. The Republican general, Titus Quinctius Flaminius, as well as the traditional Olympian deities. There may well have been many people, especially far outside the city of Rome, for whom the emperor was about as remote and powerful a figure as an Olympian deity, and who did not see much difference between the two. But wherever the formal details were spelled out, a careful distinction was drawn between the emperor and the Olympians. In Gythium, for example, and elsewhere, a technical but crucial difference was expressed. The animal sacrifices were to be performed to the traditional gods, but they were performed on behalf of or for the protection of the living emperor and his family. The emperor, in other words, was still under the protection of the Olympian gods rather than being their equal. In Rome, it was usually the numen, or the power of the living emperor, that received a sacrifice, not the emperor himself. More widely, the package of honours offered to the imperial family in the Greek world were known as isothei timai, that is, honours equivalent, iso, to those of the gods, thei, but not identical. It was always transgressive to ignore the differences between the gods and the living emperor, however godlike he might be. It was not the same when they were dead. Following the pattern of Julius Caesar, the Senate might choose to incorporate a dead emperor or one of his close relations into the official pantheon. For it was a decision that was, formally at least, in the hands of the Senate, and a posthumous power over their ruler that some senators must have enjoyed. In this case, the distinction between gods and emperors was negligible. There were priests and temples, sacrifices carried out to them, not on their behalf, and some wonderful surviving images that literally put the imperial gods in the Olympian heavens. But the differences were not entirely eroded. Roman writers, intellectuals, and artists repeatedly wondered about the nature of the transition from emperor to god, and how someone who had been a human being one day was divine the next. In a way reminiscent of the modern Catholic Church's requirement of authenticated miracles in making a new saint, they claim to ask for proof or witnesses. The appearance of a comet apparently demonstrated the apotheosis of Julius Caesar, but the stories of Livia's suspiciously large cash reward to the senator who was prepared to say he had seen Augustus ascend to heaven suggest some uncertainty about the process. The transition was fraught enough to prompt jokes and satire. According to Suetonius, Vespasian continued his down-to-earth line in self-deprecating wit right up until his last words, "Oh dear, I think I'm becoming a god." The whole process of becoming or not becoming a god is the theme of a long skit, probably written in the mid-50s CE by Lucius Annaeus Seneca, Nero's one-time tutor and later victim, reputedly on the margins of a conspiracy against him, and forced to a difficult suicide. He was so old and desiccated that, according to another ghastly set piece from Tacitus, he found it hard to get enough blood to flow from his slashed arteries. The subject of his skit is the attempt of the Emperor Claudius to be admitted to the company of the gods. We find him, having just died, last words, "Oh dear, I think I've shat myself," limping up to heaven to join the gods. Things look promising at first, especially when Hercules is the first deity to greet him, quoting Homer, which impresses the dead emperor. But when the adjudication of his case begins, the divine Augustus, giving his maiden speech in the heavenly senate, the implication is that deified emperors are rather low in the pecking order, holds up Claudius's vicious cruelty against him. "This man, fellow senators, who looks to you as if he couldn't hurt a fly, used to kill people as easily as a dog squats." And there is a dark reference to those 35 senators put to death. There is no doubt that in real-time Roman politics, Claudius was made a god. He had priests and a temple, the remains of which have been excavated. But in this fantasy he fails the test, and a tailor-made punishment is devised for him. Given his known passion for gambling, he is to spend eternity shaking dice in a bottomless dice shaker. Or, that is exactly what would have happened had not the Emperor Gaius appeared from nowhere, claimed Claudius as his slave, and handed him over to one of his staff to work for eternity as a very junior secretary in the imperial legal department. This is a nice glimpse into the new bureaucracy of the imperial regime, with all its specialist departments. It is a hilarious example of the way dead rulers were safer and easier targets than their living counterparts. It sends up the whole unlikely process by which a human emperor became a manifest god, and, in fantasy, it upturns the assassination with which this chapter started. Claudius may have become emperor, but here Gaius has the last laugh. Chapter 11. The Haves and Have-Nots. Rich and Poor. Rich Romans had a lifestyle that was luxurious by any standards, ancient or modern. The emperor, with his palatial residences, acres of parkland, the occasional revolving dining room — how well these worked, or by what mechanism, is another question — jewelled walls, and consumption on a scale that mesmerised most Roman observers, was at the very top of the spectrum, outbidding even the super-rich. His fortune was founded on the proceeds of vast imperial estates across the Roman world, that passed from one ruler to the next, and included mines and industrial properties, as well as farms, on the blurred lines between the finances of the state and of the emperor himself, and so, it was sometimes alleged, on various forms of extractions, such as forced legacies, if ready cash ran short. But many well-off inhabitants of the empire also led lives of privileged comfort. Vociferous Roman disapproval of luxury and admiration of the simple, old-fashioned peasant life coexisted, as they often do, with massive expenditure and luxurious habits. Disapprovers always need something to disapprove of, and in any case, the distinction between exquisite good taste, mine, and vulgar ostentation, yours, is necessarily a subjective one. Pliny the Younger, whose uncle, the Elder, was one of the most strident critics of extravagance, in everything from one-legged tables to wearing several rings on the same finger, described his own country villa a few miles outside Rome in one of his letters. It was, he explained, fit for purpose and not too expensive to maintain. Despite that modest description, it was actually a vast pile, with dining rooms for use in different seasons, a private bathing suite and swimming pool, courtyards and shady porticos, central heating, ample running water, a gymnasium, sunny lounges with picture windows overlooking the sea, and garden hideaways, where Pliny, who was not a man for raucous fun, could escape the noise of the parties on those rare days when the slaves took a holiday. All over the empire, the rich paraded their wealth in large and expensive accommodations for themselves, measured not by floor area, but by the number of tiles on the roof. To qualify as a local councillor, one law states, you need to have a house with 1,500 roof tiles. And they indulged in the many pleasures that money could buy, from silks to oriental spices, skilled slaves to pricey antiques. They also paraded their wealth in sponsoring amenities for their local communities. The emperor had a monopoly on public building in Rome, but in the towns of Italy and the provinces, the elite, both men and women, built themselves into prominence in much the same way. Pliny was typical in ploughing some of his money into construction projects in his hometown of Comum in northern Italy, including a new public library, which cost 1 million sesterces to construct. That is the equivalent of the minimum fortune required to be a senator. His elderly friend, Ummidia Quadratella, who died around 107 CE, did similar things in her hometown, south of Rome. Though Pliny wrote her up as a tough old lady with a fondness for board games, surviving inscriptions show that she also sponsored a new amphitheatre and temple and restored the theatre and funded a public banquet for the local council, the people and the women, in celebration of the new facilities. As far away as the small town of Timgad in North Africa, originally established on the edges of the Sahara in 100 CE as a settlement of veteran Roman soldiers, one local married couple, around 200 CE, were building themselves a mini palace on at least two floors, not so grand as Pliny's villa, but still equipped with multiple dining rooms, a private bathhouse, internal gardens, fancy water features, expensive mosaic floors, and central heating for the cold African winters. And they sponsored a huge new temple and a splendid new market, decorated with a dozen statues of themselves. Money could not protect the rich from all the discomforts and harsher sides of ancient life. Although in Rome the emperor lived at a safe remove from the masses, and the wealthy tended to favour one or two areas in particular, the Palatine Hill before the imperial palace encroached is an obvious example. For most part, ancient cities were not zoned as modern cities are. Rich and poor lived side by side. Large houses with many tiles, sharing the same streets and districts with tiny hovels. The Romans had no Mayfairs or Fifth Avenues. Travel in a curtained sedan chair carried by a team of hefty slaves might have protected a few ladies and gentlemen from the worst aspects of the public highway in any big city of the empire. But the lack of any organised refuse collection, the use of the road as a public lavatory, with the contents of chamber pots, chucked on all comers from upper floor windows, as the poet Juvenal pictures the scene, probably with some satiric exaggeration, and the noise and congestion of carts and carriages fighting for space in the streets, often too narrow for two-way traffic, would have been at the very least an assault on the senses of rich and poor alike, and sometimes dangerous. Although it is often claimed that, among notable pieces of Roman Enlightenment, wheeled transport was banned from city streets during the daytime, as if in some modern pedestrian precinct, this applied at most to heavy transport, or the ancient equivalent of juggernaut lorries. And that itself, as Juvenal also complains, could make the noise at night almost intolerable for anyone of any rank. It would even steal sleep from a drowsy emperor. Germs were no respecters of wealth either. Those rich enough to have secluded country properties had a chance of escaping the periodic epidemics of sickness that blighted all cities, especially Rome, and they made an effort to find relatively mosquito-free places to spend their summer months. A better diet might also have helped the more prosperous to withstand illnesses that those on subsistence rations could not. But the same diseases, and much the same dirt, killed the children of rich and poor alike. And anyone who went to the public baths, and that certainly includes on occasion even those who had their own bathing suites at home, risked becoming a victim of those breeding grounds of infection. One sensible Roman doctor got it absolutely right when he wrote that baths were to be avoided if you had an open wound, otherwise deathly gangrene was likely to be the result. In reality, even in the imperial palace, emperors were killed by disease more often than by poison. For more than a decade from the mid-160s CE, much of the Roman Empire suffered a pandemic, very likely smallpox, apparently brought back by soldiers serving in the East. Galen, the most acute and prolific medical writer of the ancient world, discussed individual cases and gave detailed eyewitness descriptions of the symptoms, including a blistering skin rash and diarrhea. Quite how devastating this outbreak was is still intensely debated. Firm evidence is scanty, and deaths are variously estimated at between 1% and an almost impossibly high 30% of the total population. But in 169 CE, the Emperor Lucius Verus, who from 161 CE had ruled jointly with Marcus Aurelius, was almost certainly one of the victims. There was some even-handedness, then, in these few largely biological aspects of misfortune. Yet, for the most part, the great divide in the Roman world was between the haves and the have-nots, between the tiny minority of people with substantial surplus wealth, and a lifestyle somewhere on the scale between very comfortable and extravagantly luxurious, and the vast majority of even the non-slave population, who at best had a modest amount of spare cash, for more food, for an extra room, for cheap jewellery, for simple tombstones, and at worst were destitute, jobless, and homeless. About the privilege, the haves, of the Roman world, we know a great deal. They were the authors of almost all the literature to survive from antiquity, even writers like Juvenal, who sometimes cast themselves as among the socially disadvantaged, were actually well off, despite their complaints about cascading chamber pots. And it is the rich who leave by far the biggest footprint in the archaeological record, from grand houses to new theatres. Across the empire, they amounted, at a generous estimate, to 300,000 people in all, including comparatively wealthy local bigwigs, as well as the plutocrats in the big cities, and a rather larger total if you add in their other household members. Assuming that the population of the empire in the first 2 centuries CE was somewhere between 50 and 60 million, what were the living conditions, the lifestyles and the values of the overwhelming majority, the 99% of Romans? Elite Romans were mostly disdainful of those less fortunate and less rich than themselves. Apart for their nostalgic admiration of a simple peasant way of life, a fantasy of country picnics and lazy afternoons under shady trees, they found little virtue in poverty or in the poor, or even in earning an honest day's wages. Juvenal is not the only one to write off the priorities of the Roman people as bread and circuses. Fronto, the tutor of Marcus Aurelius, makes exactly the same point when he writes of the Emperor Trajan that he understood that the Roman people are kept in line by two things beyond all else, the corn dole and entertainments. Cicero turned his scorn on those who worked for a living. The cash that comes from selling your labour is vulgar and unacceptable for a gentleman, for wages are effectively the bonds of slavery. It became a cliché of Roman moralising that a true gentleman was supported by the profits of his estates, not by wage labour, which was inherently dishonourable. Latin vocabulary itself captured the idea. The desired state of humanity was otium, not so much leisure, as it is usually translated, but the state of being in control of one's own time. Business of any kind was its undesirable opposite. Negotium, not otium. Those who became wealthy from nothing were usually the objects of snobbish derision, as jumped-up arrivists. The character of Trimalchio, the nouveau riche ex-slave in Petronius's Satyricon, who has made his fortune trading everything from bacon and perfume to slaves, is a simultaneously engaging and ghastly fictional parody of a man with more cash than good taste who repeatedly gets proper elite behaviour slightly wrong, He keeps his own slaves in rather too vulgar designer uniforms. The porter at Trimalchio's front door is dressed in green with a red belt and spends his time shelling peas into a silver bowl. The walls of his house are boastfully decorated with paintings that tell the story of his career from the slave market to his current splendour, under the protection of Mercury, the god of money-making. And the dinner party he hosts is an impossible combination of every Roman fancy food, from dormice, prepared in honey and poppy seeds, to wine that was well over 100 years old, vintage 121 BCE, when Opimius was consul. The ignorant Trimalchio presumably does not realise that the name of the die-hard conservative, who in 121 BCE had 3,000 supporters of Gaius Gracchus's put to death, is hardly an auspicious name for a vintage, even if wine lasted that long anyway. The prejudices are obvious, and they tell us more about the world of the writers than of their subjects, especially if, as some modern critics have suggested, Petronius's parody of the elite lifestyle was meant to make his elite readers wonder quite how different they really were from this vulgar ex-slave. The big question is whether and how we can recreate a picture of the lives of ordinary Romans that they themselves might have recognised. If surviving literature produces these disdainful caricatures, where else can we turn? Degrees of poverty. The 50 million or so inhabitants of the Roman Empire did not fall into one single category. Roman society was not divided simply into a small group of the very rich and the rest, a fairly undifferentiated mass struggling on the breadline. Among those who must count as the non-elite, there were different degrees of privilege, status and money, and they included plenty of ordinary or middling types, as well as the very poor. It proves much easier to get a glimpse into the lives of some of these types than of others. The majority of the 50 million would have been peasant farmers, not the fantasy creation of Roman writers, but smallholders across the empire, struggling to grow enough to feed themselves in some years, doing better with a small surplus to sell in others. For these families, Roman rule made little difference beyond a different tax collector, a bigger economy into which to sell their produce, and a wider range of trinkets to buy if they had any spare cash. In Britain, for example, so far as we can tell from the archaeological traces, there was little significant change in the lives of peasant farmers over more than a millennium. From the end of the Iron Age, immediately before the successful Roman invasion in 43 CE, through the Roman occupation and into the Middle Ages. But there is almost no evidence surviving for the attitudes, aspirations, hopes or fears of these farmers and their families. The only ordinary people in the Roman world we can get to know in that sense, or whose style of life we can begin to reconstruct, are those who lived in the towns and cities. There was certainly extreme urban poverty. Roman laws expressly forbade any squatting in tombs. Anyone who so wishes may prosecute a person who lives or makes his dwelling in a tomb, one Roman legal opinion runs. The implication is that there were homeless people, whether locals or foreigners, citizens, new immigrants or runaway slaves, doing exactly that, camping out in the grand tombs of the aristocracy that lined the roads into most big cities of the empire. Others, it seems, preferred to put up lean-to huts against any convenient wall, from arches to aqueducts, which, according to other laws, could be demolished if they were judged to be a fire risk, or charged a rent if not. The outskirts of many Roman towns may have been not far different from those of modern third world cities, covered in squatter settlements or shanty towns, populated by the nearly starving and those who begged as much as worked for their living. Roman moralists make numerous references to beggars, often to the effect that they are better ignored, and a series of paintings in Pompeii depicting life in the local forum includes a cameo scene of a hunched beggar, with a dog, being handed some small change by a posh lady and her maid, who are not obeying the moralist's advice. There is, in fact, rather less evidence for this kind of borderline destitution than we might expect. But the reasons for that are clear. First, those with nothing leave very few traces in the historical or archaeological record. Ephemeral shanty towns do not leave a permanent imprint in the soil. Those buried with nothing in unmarked graves tell us much less about themselves than those accompanied by an eloquent epitaph. But second, and even more to the point, extreme poverty in the Roman world was a condition that usually solved itself. Its victims died. Those without some support mechanism could not survive. Even the corn dole in the city of Rome, the descendant of Gaius Gracchus's initiative in the 120s BCE, did not provide that. It certainly underlined the responsibility of the state for the basic food of its citizens. But the beneficiaries were a large but still limited and privileged group of about 250,000 male citizens in the 1st and 2nd centuries CE who received enough to keep about two people in bread. The dole was not a safety net for all comers. Many more people occupied the next rungs up on the ladder of wealth, and they have left clearer traces of their lives. There is still a wide spectrum of privilege and comfort. At one end were those with a relatively secure livelihood, often from manufacturing, producing and selling anything from basic bread to fancy clothing. They were families living in several rooms, sometimes above the shop or workshop, possibly with a couple of slaves, even if, as was often the case, they were ex-slaves themselves or the children of ex-slaves. A particularly intimate view of lifestyle at this level comes from a cesspit excavated underneath a small block of retail units and apartments in the town of Herculaneum, Pompey's neighbour, also destroyed by the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 CE. The contents of the cesspit, still being analysed, are what came down directly from the simple lavatories of the modest flats above. Having already passed through the digestive tracts of roughly 150 residents. It was a varied and decent diet. Among other things, they were eating fish, sea urchins, fragments of the spike survive, chicken, eggs, walnut and figs. The pips go straight through intestines, undigested. Those living on upper floors also used the lavatories as rudimentary waste disposal units to get rid of broken glass and crockery, as well as accidentally dropping their gemstones down them. These were people who had some money to spend, household utensils to spare, and jewellery to lose. At the other end of the spectrum were those in a much more precarious position. Men, women, and children with no permanent trade or particular skill, who must have tried to pick up casual work in bars and restaurants or the sex industry, as porters or hauliers at the docks or as navvies on building sites. Plenty of such labour was needed. One rough and ready estimate, calculating the total quantity of staples, oil, wine and grain, that must have been imported to keep 1 million people in the city of Rome alive, reckons it would have taken more than 9 million single porter loads to get the stuff from ship to shore in sacks or amphorae each year. Those loads alone would have provided enough work for 3,000 men for about 100 days. But it was seasonal, hence the use of free labourers on a casual basis rather than slaves, and it meant an uncertain livelihood. Many of these people must have often gone hungry. Telltale lesions in surviving skeletons, especially their teeth, point to various forms of malnutrition, affecting not only the very poorest in the city. They would have lived in the ancient equivalent of hostels, renting by the hour, or sharing a single room with several others and sleeping in shifts. They would probably not even have enjoyed many of the entertainments, often supposed to have been the staple and the passion of the Roman poor. The seating capacity of the Colosseum, vast as it seems, was around 50,000, which in a city of 1 million probably means that the audience for gladiatorial shows and bloody beast hunts was relatively upmarket. It was not made up of these people, who, if they only fell one rung lower, would have been camping in a tomb or in a squatter settlement. The huge multi-story apartment blocks, insulae, or islands, common in Rome and its port of Ostia, symbolise this hierarchy among the more ordinary Romans and capture the spectrum from the reasonably comfortable to those only barely hanging on. Insulae provided rented accommodation at a high density, which is how such a large population managed to cram into a relatively small area in the city of Rome. They were attractive investment opportunities for their owners and provided a job for ruthless rent collectors. The epitaph of one tenant, Ancaenus Nothus, an ex-slave who died at the age of 43 and whose ashes were buried in a shared tomb just outside the walls of Rome, hints at common complaints in some simple lines of verse, as if spoken from the afterlife. I'm no longer worried that I shall die of hunger. I'm rid of aching legs and getting a deposit for my rent. I'm enjoying free board and lodging for eternity. But even if the landlord came down heavily on all of them, some tenants lived much more comfortably than others. The basic logic was always that the lower down in the building you lived, the more spacious and expensive your accommodation was, and the higher up in the building, the cheaper, pokier, and more dangerous, with no facilities for cooking or washing, and no means of escape in the frequent event of a fire. As Juvenal jokes, someone living at the top, with nothing to keep him from the rain but the roof tiles, was simply the last one to die if a blaze started further down. The logic is exactly the reverse of that of the modern apartment block with its luxury penthouses, and it is perfectly illustrated in one of the best-preserved insulae in the city of Rome, still visible just underneath the Capitoline Hill, and within a few metres of the shining temples that once stood there. Literally shining, by the end of the 1st century CE, the Temple of Jupiter was roofed with gilded tiles. In this block, shops with living accommodation on a mezzanine occupied the street level. The first floor, or piano nobile, contained a few spacious apartments. By the fourth floor, which still survives, there were a series of small bedsits, though each probably housed a family rather than a single person. And above, it must have been worse. The city's lack of zoning meant that some of the grandest public celebrations on the Capitoline took place within a stone's throw of what was on its upper floors, a slum. It is the world of the people who occupied these blocks and others like them that is the theme of the rest of this chapter. Realistically, it will be more the world of those on the lower floors than those on the upper. The more disposable income that people had, the more evidence they have left for us. We will look at the world of work, of leisure, of culture and of anxiety. Not just where and how the non-elite lived, but also how they faced the inequality of Roman life, what fun they enjoyed and what resources they had against adversity of all kinds, from petty crime to pain and sickness. The world of work. Cicero and most of the elite professed to despise wage labour. But for the majority of the urban inhabitants of the Roman world, as now, their job was the key to their identity. It was usually tough. Most people who needed a regular income to survive, and that was most people, worked, if they could, until they died. The army was an exception in having any kind of retirement package, and even that usually involved working a small farm. Many children worked as soon as they were physically capable, whether they were free or slave. Skeletons of the very young have been discovered in excavations, with clear signs in their bones and joints of hard physical labour. One particular cemetery, just outside Rome, near an ancient laundry and textile works, contains the remains of young people who obviously had years of heavy work behind them, showing the effects of the stamping and treading needed in the treatment of cloth, rather than of skipping and ball games. Children are even commemorated as workers in their epitaphs. Modern sensibilities might hope that the simple tombstone in Spain of a 4-year-old child, shown carrying his mining tools, was put up in memory of some young local mining mascot. Most likely he was an active worker. Only the offspring of the rich spent their youth learning grammar, rhetoric, philosophy, and how to make speeches. Or the less meaty syllabus from reading and writing to spinning and music offered to girls. Child labour was the norm. It is not a problem or even a category most Romans would have understood. The invention of childhood and the regulation of what work children could do only came 1500 years later and is still a peculiarly Western preoccupation. Their tombstones make clear how important work was to the personal identity of ordinary Romans. Whereas Scipio Barbatus and others like him at the top of the social hierarchy emphasized the political offices that they had held or the battles they had won, many more people blazoned what they did as a job, often alongside the visual emblems of their craft. More than 200 occupations are known in this way from the city of Rome alone. Men and women, or whoever commissioned their memorials, often summarised their careers in just a few words and images, with a job description and some recognisable symbols. Gaius Pupius Amicus, for example, an ex-slave and by trade a dyer of purple, a notoriously expensive dye extracted from tiny shellfish, and according to law, used only to colour cloth worn by senators and the emperor, proudly described himself as a purpuarius and had various items of his craft equipment carved on the stone. Other tombs displayed sculptured panels depicting the deceased in action at their job, from midwives and butchers to a particularly splendid cellar of poultry. Occasionally the whole tomb was designed even more ambitiously to display the craft of the dead person, as if to equate the man or woman with the job itself. In the late 1st century BCE, one enterprising baker was responsible for a large memorial to himself and his wife in a prime position just outside the Roman city walls. Marcus Virgilius Eurystheses was likely an ex-slave, and to judge from the scale of the tomb, 10 meters high. He had made a large amount of money from his business. The inscribed epitaph describes him as a baker and contractor, which points at the very least to a chain of bakeries and probably some lucrative public contracts for bread supply. The whole edifice is constructed in the shape of bread-making equipment, and around the top, where on official monuments you would expect a sculpted frieze, depicting something like a religious procession or a triumph, there are instead scenes from the working life in one of Eurystheses' bakeries. A figure in a toga directing operations is presumably meant to be the man himself. If Eurystheses knew of Cicero's disparaging words on the nature of trade and of wage labour, then this tomb would be the equivalent of two fingers put up to such snobbery. Equally, a passing aristocrat might well have thought that there was a touch of Trimalchio about it. But more than individual identity was at stake here. There were communal and social aspects too. As trades and crafts provided a context for joint activities among their workers, for promotion of the interests they held in common, and for a shared sense of identity, all across the empire, local trade associations, collegia, flourished, with members who were both slave and free, a combination reflecting the usual mixture of statuses in most kinds of work. In one collegium, based just outside Rome, rules drawn up in the 2nd century CE stipulated that any slave member who was granted his freedom had to donate an amphora of good wine to the others, presumably for the celebratory party. Sometimes they had impressive headquarters, usually a defined administrative structure, rules and regulations, entry fees and annual subscriptions, and they could act as political pressure groups, talking shops, dining clubs and burial insurance agencies. For one element of the members' subscriptions to the association regularly went towards guaranteeing them a decent funeral, which may partly account for the prominence of job descriptions on epitaphs. You were buried as a carpenter in a funeral paid for by carpenters. These were a long way from guilds in the medieval sense. They did not set qualifications for practising particular crafts or impose what was effectively a closed shop. Nor were they exactly the ancient version of a trades union or business cartel, although it seems, from a surviving ruling of the provincial governor there, that the bakers of Ephesus, in what is now Turkey, did cause a riot in the middle of the 2nd century CE by going out on strike. And Petronius, as one of his characters in the Satyricon, complained that the bakers, again, are in league with the local officials to keep the bread prices high. But at some point, an historic stake in Roman society was invented for these associations. There was a tall but important story that it was the second king of Rome, Numa, who first established them, to include the builders, bronze workers, potters, goldsmiths, dyers, leather processors, and musicians. Whoever dreamt this up, and it was a dream, was giving the craftsmen and their organisations a genealogy that went back almost as far as it was possible to go in Roman history. Evidence for the public profile of trades and workers can still be found at Pompeii. The electoral slogans, visible even now on the walls of the town, the temporary painted signs urging the voters to back this or that candidate in the elections to the local council, provide one example. These are not unlike modern political posters, though they are rather more standardised, usually taking the form of a simple sentence along the lines of Crescens asks for Gnaeus Helvius Sabinus as aedile. Variations on the theme include a few traces of negative campaigning. The Little Thieves ask for Vatia as aedile was presumably much the same thing as saying don't vote for Vatia. But there is also a series of notices that give a candidate the backing of a particular group of tradesmen, including the bakers, carpenters, chicken keepers, laundry workers, and mule drivers. How formal this backing was is uncertain. We should not necessarily imagine some official vote of endorsement by the local association, though that might have been the case. But at the very least, some of them had got together to decide that as laundry workers or whatever, they were supporting one candidate rather than another. Pompeii also allows us a rare view into the working environment of some of these people, in particular into the laundries. Roman laundry work and textile processing, a combination conventionally known as fulling, was not a glamorous trade. One of the staple ingredients in this process was human urine, which was the source of the joke attributed to the Emperor Vespasian about money not smelling. And the young skeletons found in the cemetery near the textile works outside Rome show the intense stresses and strains of the physical labour involved. But one of the many fulleries in Pompeii gives an alternative picture of the industry for the consumption of the fullers themselves. Decorating the working areas where the men, and it was mostly men, pummeled and processed the cloth in whatever foul-smelling mixture they used, were paintings of exactly those elaborate and messy processes going on. It was these paintings that the men saw a version of what they were doing reflected back to them in a sanitised, even glamorised form as they went about their long day's work. Cicero's rivals may have mocked him, incorrectly or not, for being the son of a laundry proprietor. But in this laundry at Pompeii, as in many others, no doubt across the empire, the launderers were offered an image of the nobility of labour, a pride in its execution, and a sense of belonging that Cicero would never have dreamt of. Bar culture. Elite Romans were often even more dismissive and anxious about what the rest of the population got up to when they were not working. Their keenness for shows and spectacles was one thing, but even worse were the bars and cheap cafes and restaurants where ordinary men tended to congregate. Lurid images were conjured up of the types of people you were likely to meet there. Juvenal, for example, pictures a seedy drinking den at the port of Ostia, patronised, he claims, by cutthroats, sailors, thieves and runaway slaves, hangmen and coffin-makers, plus the occasional eunuch priest, presumably off duty from the sanctuary of the Great Mother in the town. And writing later, in the 4th century CE, one Roman historian complained that the lowest sort of person spent the whole night in bars, and he picked out as especially disgusting the snorting noise the dice players made as they concentrated on the board and drew in breath through their snotty noses. There are also records of repeated attempts to impose legal restrictions or taxes on these establishments. Tiberius, for example, apparently banned the sale of pastries. Claudius is supposed to have abolished taverns entirely and to have forbidden the serving of boiled meat and hot water, presumably to be mixed in the standard Roman fashion with wine. But then why not ban the wine? And Vespasian is said to have ruled that bars and pubs should sell no form of food at all except peas and beans. Assuming that all this is not a fantasy of ancient biographers and historians, it can only have been fruitless posturing, legislation at its most symbolic, which the resources of the Roman state had no means to enforce. Elites everywhere tend to worry about places where the lower orders congregate, and, though there was certainly a rough side and some rude talk, the reality of the normal bar was tamer than its reputation. For bars were not just drinking dens, but an essential part of everyday life for those who had, at best, limited cooking facilities in their lodgings. As with the arrangement of apartment blocks, the Roman pattern is precisely the reverse of our own. The Roman rich, with their kitchens and multiple dining rooms, ate at home. The poor, if they wanted much more than the ancient equivalent of a sandwich, had to eat out. Roman towns were full of cheap bars and cafes, and it was here that a large number of ordinary Romans spent many hours of their non-working lives. Pompeii is again one of the best examples. Taking account of the still unexcavated parts of the town, and resisting the temptation, as some archaeologists have not, to call any building with a serving counter a bar, we can reckon that there were well over 100 such places there, for a population of perhaps 12,000 residents and travellers passing through. They were built to a fairly standard plan, a counter facing the pavement for the takeaway service, an inner room with tables and chairs for the eat-in waiter service, and usually a display stand for food and drink, as well as a brazier or oven for preparing hot dishes and drinks. In a couple of cases at Pompeii, in the same way as in the Fullery, their decoration includes a series of paintings depicting scenes, part fantasy, part real, of life in the bar itself. There is not much evidence of the terrible moral turpitude that Roman writers feared. One image shows the wine supplies being delivered in a large vat, another some snacks being consumed underneath sausages and other delicacies strung from the ceiling. The worst signs are one full-on image of sex, hard to make out now because some modern moralist has defaced it, a number of graffiti along the lines of "I fucked the landlady," whether statement of fact, boast or insult is impossible to say, and several paintings which show customers playing dice games, presumably for money, snorting or not. On the walls of one bar, where speech bubbles accompany the pictures to flesh out what is going on, the game is leading to a fight and to some decidedly ungentlemanly language. After a disputed throw, it was a two, not a three. The landlord has to intervene. "If you want to fight, get outside," he is saying, as landlords always do, while the pair start to foul-mouth each other. "Scumbag, I had the three, I won. No, come on, cocksucker, I did." Gambling and board games were one of the most extreme cases of Roman elite double standards. Some of the loftiest aristocrats were keen gamers. According to Suetonius, the Emperor Claudius was such an enthusiast that he wrote a book on dice games and had his carriage specially adapted so that he could continue playing on the move. While the first Augustus was so addicted to gaming, but so mindful of the purses of his friends, that he would simply give his guests large quantities of cash to use as their stake. Though Suetonius hints at his own disapproval when he observes that Augustus did not seek to deny his habit, and compares it archly to another of the emperor's supposed hobbies, deflowering virgins. Board games were not only a man's pastime either. They were a favourite recreation of the elderly Eumidia Quadratilla too, whether played for money or not, Pliny does not say. But as Juvenal observes, on this occasion pointing a well-directed finger at Roman hypocrisy, when the ordinary people indulged in these games, the elite were outraged and thought it a disgrace. One of their main objections was that dicing was a gateway to crime. The brawl depicted in the Pompeian Bar points to that on a very small scale. On a grander scale, the prominence of dicers, aleatores, among Catiline's followers suggested a connection with conspiracy and treason. But in the heads of the rich and powerful, the destabilizing effect of gambling was a major factor too. In a world where the hierarchy of wealth had always directly correlated with political power and social status, the possibility, however remote, of the established order being upturned by money that was obtained solely by chance was dangerously disruptive. The riches of Trimalchio were bad enough. The idea that a fortune might be obtained by a throw of the dice was far worse. So there were attempts to control gambling among the general population, to restrict it to particular times or occasions, and to limit the legal responsibility for recovering the debts incurred. This legislation had about as much effect as the restriction on bars. Gaming boards are found all over the Roman world. Those that survive are in durable stone and come from tombs, bars, and army barracks, or are carved into pavements and into the steps of public buildings, presumably intended as an amusement for people with time on their hands. Dice games had different names and were played by different rules and on different designs of board. No one has ever managed to reconstruct quite how any of these games worked in detail. It is rather like trying to figure out how to play Monopoly without the instructions or any of the pieces or the cards. But, despite that, one common type of board offers some memorable glimpses of the atmosphere of play and the attitudes of the players. These boards were made for a game that clearly involved moving pieces across 36 points, arranged in three rows of 12, each row divided into two groups of six. But taking the place of the squares that are usually found on a modern board are letters of the alphabet, and the players moved their pieces from letter to letter. The letters are often carefully arranged to read as words so that the boards proclaim some snappy slogans, in six words of six letters each. These were some of the mottos of bar culture and of the gamers themselves. A few are slightly dourly moralizing, reflecting on the downsides of the very activity that the boards were designed for. The nasty dots on the dice compel even the skilled player to play by luck. Invida puncta jubent felice ludere doctum. Or, the board is a circus. Retire when you're beaten. You don't know how to play. Tabula circus victus. Recede ludere nescis. More are triumphalist in a very Roman way, even if they hark back to rather old triumphs. The Parthians have been slaughtered. The Britons conquered. Play on, Romans. Parthi occisi, Brito victus, ludite Romani, as one board, probably of the 3rd century CE, proclaims. Others stress a down-to-earth popular hedonism referring to the races in the Circus Maximus. The circus is packed, the people shout, the citizens are having fun. Circus plenus, clamor populi, gaudia civium, or to even simpler pleasures of life. On the steps of the forum at Timgad, one board sums it all up with hunting, bathing, gaming, laughing, that's living. Venare, lavare, ludere, ridere, hoc est vivere. Those slogans undercut some of the stern disapproval of the Roman elite, capturing the banter and zest of bar life, the pleasure that ordinary people could take in being Roman, from circuses to conquest, and a no-nonsense view of what amounted to good living and contentment. It was with slogans like this that the average Pompeian laundry worker sat down in the evening in his local bar, with a glass or two of wine mixed with hot water, a friend, a board and some dice, and dreamt about gambling his way into a better life. One or two did get lucky. A scrawled graffito at Pompeii records the delight of one winner at his gaming victory in a nearby town. "I won at Nucera, playing dice. 855.5 denarii. Honestly, it's true." It was, as the excitement of the scrawler makes clear, an almost unbelievable win and a substantial sum. At 4 sesterces to the denarius, it amounted to almost 4,000 sesterces, or roughly 4 times the annual salary of a Roman soldier. It must have made a big difference to the winner. He cannot have been desperately poor in the first place. As the shrewd Augustus realized, gambling always required a stake and, even in the bars and on street corners, was the pastime of those with a bit of spare cash. Presumably a win of this size would have meant improved lodgings, new clothes, faster transport. 500 sesterces would buy a new mule, and better food and wine. 1 sesterce, according to a surviving Pompeian price list, would buy a glass or pitcher of the best Falernian vintage, 4 times the cost of the local plonk. But whatever the paranoia of the elite, none of this was likely to undermine the foundation of the social order. Putting up and making do. 4,000 sesterces was, in any case, a rare win and beyond the dreams of most small-time gamblers in local bars. Even the simplest slogans on the game boards would have been aspirational for some. Hunting, bathing, gaming, laughing might have been basic pleasures for those in country towns like Timgad, but for men and women on the street in Rome, hunting was only a dream. For those at the top of an insular block, the races, as in the circuses packed, would have been a rare treat, though more within reach than the gladiatorial shows. The capacity of the Circus Maximus, the main racetrack, at 250,000, was 5 times that of the Colosseum. Even those living at the more comfortable, lower levels of the insulae would have faced, in our terms, a risky future. Their comfort was always precarious. Some modern historians have even speculated that the popularity of games of chance among ordinary Romans had something to do with the close match to the structure of their lives. For most of the Roman people, life was always a gamble, and making money not far short of a lottery. To be living adequately at one moment was no guarantee for the next. Those who are making a small profit today could be derailed tomorrow by some illness that would prevent them from working, by the regular floods or fires that would wreck their homes. The grandeur of the remains of the city of Rome and its 19th century flood defences, which have largely prevented devastating inundations, can deflect our attention from the natural disasters that repeatedly fell upon the place, and unequally on the rich and the poor, even though they often lived as close neighbours. A few metres of extra height up the slope of a hill would have given a rich house protection from floods that inundated the nicer apartments in low-lying insulae. Fire could be a problem for anyone. In a terrible blaze in 192 CE, Galen lost the contents of his lock-up storeroom near the Forum, including some of his medical writing, doctor's instruments, medicines, and other valuables, as we learn from the manuscript of his essay on the subject that was rediscovered only in 2005. But it was a particular problem in a high-rise block, especially when the residents tried to cook or keep warm with unstable braziers on the upper floors. Petty and not-so-petty crime might regularly have left any of these people without their savings, their precious possessions, their clothes, or the tools of their trade. Then, as now, the rich with their guard dogs, and the equivalent of security systems in the shape of slaves, complained most loudly about house crime and street robbery. The poor were the main victims. Some of the stories preserved in handwritten papyrus documents discovered in Roman Egypt, often even more immediate and informal than the public pronouncements inscribed on stone elsewhere in the empire, give personal accounts of the everyday crime, violence, and thuggery that was endemic. One man, for example, complains of a group of lads attacking his house, beating him up on every limb of my body, and walking off with some of his clothes, including a tunic and a cloak, a pair of scissors and some beer. Another claims that some ne'er-do-well who owed him money had turned up at his house and attacked his pregnant wife, who had miscarried and was now in danger of her life. More than 3,000 miles away in the town of Bath, then Aquasulis, in the province of Britain, other inscribed records point to persistent thieving of clothes and accessories, from rings to gloves, and especially cloaks. There were few resources, and almost no regular public services, to mitigate these crises. In the city of Rome, by the 1st century CE, there was a small and rudimentary fire service, but it was equipped with only a few blankets and pails of water and vinegar to douse the flames, and relied more on demolition of the surrounding properties to break the blaze, which was a good idea, unless you lived in one of those properties. And there was no police force to whom crimes could be reported, or through whom redress could be sought. Most victims of crime would have relied on their own strong arms, or friends, family, or local vigilantes, to get even with the person they believed responsible. There was no system for dealing effectively through official channels with ordinary wrongdoing, only a cycle of rough justice and brutal retaliation. The unfortunate pregnant wife who miscarried after her assault might have been a victim of just that, despite the tear-jerking account by her apparently innocent aggrieved husband. The story of one Roman shopkeeper hints at the start of another cycle. One dark evening he had pursued a thief who had stolen a lamp from near his counter. In the struggle that followed, the thief got out a whip and set about lashing the shopkeeper, who retaliated and in the process knocked out one of the assailant's eyes. The sophisticated edifice of Roman law, despite its extraordinary expertise in formulating legal rules and principles, deciding issues of responsibility and determining rights of ownership and contract, had little impact on the lives of those below the elite and offered little help for their problems. When they tried to use it, the system was sometimes simply overloaded. We do not know how far the complaints of those ordinary victims in Roman Egypt ever progressed, even though they were aimed at officials in the province, in the hope of some legal action. But we do know from another papyrus document that at the beginning of the 3rd century CE, one governor of Egypt, the prefect, as he was called there, had received in just 3 days, in a single place, more than 1,800 petitions from those wanting to press cases or complaints. The majority of them must have been brushed under the carpet. Most of the time, the official institutions of the law were not interested in the problems of the ordinary people, or vice versa. Occasionally, Roman academics and specialists in the law looked at the misfortunes of the poor as knotty case studies. They agreed, for example, that the shopkeeper had not acted unlawfully, provided the thief really had used his whip first. And even more occasionally, especially in matters of inheritance and civil status, ordinary people found it worth obtaining a legal ruling. At Herculaneum, for example, several documents have been discovered that were written on wax tablets. The pen scratches are still visible on the wood that lay under the original wax, and record a number of witness statements taken in a tricky and now baffling local dispute. The question turned on whether a woman from the town had been born a slave or free. Like most people in the Roman world, she had no formal proof of status, and in this case, the result is unknown, someone had the time, contacts and cash to take the issue to the very top in Rome itself. But in general, the law was out of reach of most of the population, who, as we shall soon see, often looked on trials and legal processes more as a threat to be feared than as a possible protection. So, if not to the law, where did the ordinary people look for help beyond family and friends? Often it was to alternative support systems, to the gods, to the supernatural, and to those, such as cheap fortune tellers, who claimed to have access to knowledge about the future and the outcome of problems, and about whom the elite were predictably sniffy. The only reason we know about the cloak crime in Roman Bath is because people went to the sacred spring of Sulis, the local goddess, and inscribed a curse on the thief on small lead tablets and cast them into the water. Many of these tablets have been discovered with their angry or desperate messages. Docilanius, son of Brucarius, to the most holy goddess Sulis, I curse whoever stole my hooded cloak, whether man or woman, slave or free, that the goddess Sulis inflict death on him and not let him sleep or have children now or in the future, until he brings my cloak to the temple of her divinity, as one runs, typical of many. One of the alternative resources, and one of the strangest documents to have survived from classical antiquity, takes us directly into the specific problems and anxieties that afflicted the lives of the men and women on the ancient street. Titled The Oracles of Astrampsicus, after a legendary ancient Egyptian magician, with whom it had nothing to do whatsoever, and claiming implausibly in its introduction to have been written by the philosopher Pythagoras and to have been the secret behind the success of Alexander the Great, it is, in fact, an off-the-peg fortune-telling kit, dating probably to the 2nd century CE, centuries after either Pythagoras or Alexander. It consists of a numbered list of 92 questions that someone might want to ask of a fortune teller, plus a list of more than 1,000 possible answers. The idea was that the questioner chose the question that best represented his or her problem and gave its number to the fortune teller, who, by following the kit's instructions, which involved a good deal of mumbo-jumbo, choosing more numbers, taking away the number you first thought of, and so on, was eventually directed to the single right answer out of the 1,000. Whoever compiled the oracles thought those 92 questions summed up the problems that were most likely to send people to the cheap local clairvoyant. One or two may suggest some relatively upmarket customers. Will I become a senator? Was hardly a concern for many, though it may have been the kind of fantasy question that, will I marry a handsome prince, has been in the modern world posed by those unlikely to meet, still less marry, a member of any royal family. Most of the questions focus on much more ordinary anxieties. Some, predictably, are about health, marriage and children. Number 42. Will I survive the illness? Must have been a common choice. Though it is interesting that have I been poisoned also appears on the list, a suspicion obviously not restricted to the imperial house. Number 24. Is my wife having a baby? Is nicely balanced by the guilty query, will I soon be caught as an adulterer? And by, will I rear the baby? Pointing to the ancient dilemma of whether to expose a newborn. It is clear also that slaves were among the intended customers. Will I be freed? And will I be sold? And that travel was seen as one of life's pressing dangers. Is the traveller alive? And will I sail safely? But the main preoccupation is money and livelihood, appearing in question after question. Will I be able to borrow the money? Will I open a workshop? Will I pay back what I owe? Are my belongings going to be sold at auction? Will I inherit from a friend? The law, when it is present, tends to be a looming menace, from am I safe from prosecution to will I be safe if someone informs